What joy it was to be in work again. The scared and ashamed feeling of being out of work left me almost immediately, and I told myself that no lad would ever be as willing as I would be. I might even learn about film projection if I kept my eyes and ears open, and I might even rise one day to be the manager of a cinema myself. A vista of golden opportunity opened out before me, and the pay was my accustomed 12 shillings and 6 pence a week, so my rash folly had paid off. My duties at the cinema, which was the same picture house my grandmother and I patronized, began at 9 o'clock in the morning, when I appeared punctually in working clothes to sweep out the cinema, scrub the vestibule and make myself generally useful, until 3 o'clock when I had 2 hours off. At 5 o'clock, wearing my inherited uniform, I was standing at the cinema entrance to keep the various queues in order. I tried to stop them causing an obstruction on the pavement. I pounced on those who sneaked ahead of others who had waited longer and coaxed them back into line, and I politely answered such questions as, has the Idiresis Negation LM got a happy ending? Or is there a gent's toilet? My day ended when the cinema closed at 10:30. It was a long day, but I did not mind, because in addition to my 12 shillings and 6 pence wage, I had the delightful perk of moments when I could watch the Idiresis Negation LM from the door at the back of the stalls. These snatches of watching could add up to nearly the entire Idiresis Negation LM in 3 days, and, as the program changed midweekly, I could see almost 2 films in a week, more than I could ever afford in the days when I had to pay for a tip-up seat. There was a dance hall in the lower part of the cinema building where a dance was held every Saturday night. I had to be on duty in the gentleman's cloakroom on these occasions, to hand out numbered tickets in exchange for hats and coats, and when things were quiet in the cloakroom I would carry trays of drinks around at the barman's behest. I was not paid extra for these dance nights, but I was given a saucer to put on the cloakroom counter into which the customers would drop a penny or tuppence when they handed in or collected their coats, so these tips were my bonus. On occasion the coppers in the saucer might add up to a cool 3 shillings, and I considered myself amply recompensed. I began to take an interest in the dancing on these Saturday nights. Whenever I was free for a few minutes I would stand at the edge of the dance floor watching the dancers, envying their expertise. In those days they were dancing the foxtrot, the waltz, the tango and the new craze called the Charleston. I longed to be able to do the dances I saw, and I would watch the dancers, memorizing the steps, then dash into my cloakroom to try them out before I forgot them. Eventually I thought I might make a fair showing at most of the ballroom dances, and I longed to be able to practice with a partner. This was impossible. It was as much as my job was worth to even dare approach any of the lady patrons of the dance hall, so I contented myself with the floor mop which was kept in the cloakroom, holding it in my arms and imagining it was one of the attractive girls I had seen on the dance floor, and even if my imagination had to work overtime the mop was better than no one at all. One night the floor mop and I were practicing a waltz when we were interrupted by one of the patrons, whose dancing I had often admired from my vantage point at the edge of the dance floor. From the expression on his face when he saw me dancing so earnestly with the mop, he must have thought I had gone out of my mind, so when he asked me what on earth I was doing, although I felt a perfect ninny, I told him. To my astonishment he removed the mop from my grasp and took me in his arms. "Let me show you a new step which hasn't even reached St. Albans yet," he offered, and started to waltz me around the cloakroom, illustrating the new step as we went. But I was learning it the wrong way, because I had to follow his lead as if I were the lady. I was trying to get the hang of the new step well enough to be able to practice it the right way around with the mop later, when the lesson ended abruptly with the entrance of the manager. The manager looked very black, and he asked my teacher to either return to the dance floor or leave if he preferred it. The patron seemed confused and embarrassed and hurried out, which left me to face the wrath of the manager alone. I expected the worst, because we were not supposed to be familiar with the paying guests, but the manager spoke quite kindly. "Keep away from that man," he said. "He's queer." Now, I had never heard the word used in a homosexual context before, so I suppose I looked baffled. Well, never mind, just attend to your duties properly in future, and if I find you with him again, you'll be sacked on the spot. He went out, leaving me to wonder if my would-be teacher had escaped from old Shelley Asylum or somewhere, but I was determined to avoid him like the plague from then on, in case I lost my job. As the weeks passed and I went on practicing with my mop, I began to long for a real girl as a partner, and finally I decided that my bonus of Saturday coppers would pay for dancing lessons on my one free night a week. So I scouted around and enrolled in Miss Florence's School of Dancing, where I would be given lessons in modern ballroom dancing for 2 shillings a session. Miss Florence's school was held in a large bare room at the back of an office building. Music for the lessons was provided sometimes by an elderly lady pianist, and at other times by a cabinet gramophone, which I preferred because I thought it was more like the music at a real dance. Miss Florence was an excellent teacher, and after a few months of her tuition I was proficient enough to decide to stop my lessons and devote my nights and my 2 shillings to escorting a fair-haired girl I had my eye on to real dances. With this in mind, I arrived at the school for what I intended to be my final lesson, and when it was over I lingered after the rest of the class had gone to tell Miss Florence I was not coming back again. To my surprise, she offered to continue my lessons free of charge if I would give her some help with her more backward pupils. Naturally, I was flattered, but I wanted to have fun on my future nights off, and I refused as politely as I could. Miss Florence was tall, slim, elegant and self-assured, and I could hardly believe my ears when she actually pleaded with me to stay on in the class. The reason emerged as we talked, and I soon found myself pitying this aloof, poised lady who had seemed so far removed from the squalid little problems which bothered ordinary people like me. It turned out Miss Florence had to support an elderly ailing mother, and the school was not making enough money to employ a second teacher to give individual attention to the slower pupils, so consequently they were threatening to take their custom elsewhere. Whether my vanity or my sympathy was titillated the more by Miss Florence's confidence I do not know to this day, and banishing the pleasing picture of myself and a blonde heartthrob gliding together over some ballroom floor to the spontaneous applause of the onlookers, I agreed to remain in the class on Miss Florence's terms. I was soon to discover the backward pupils were either men or overweight and rigidly corseted matrons, and trying to instill into them the joys of the dance was heavy going indeed. How I longed to go to a real dance with a real partner who would follow my lead and feel light as a feather in my arms, but unless I changed my job for one which left me free in the evenings, it seemed unlikely I would ever get the chance. I remembered the shamed feeling of being out of work too vividly to risk giving up the job I had in the hope of finding another. I tried to console myself with the thought that at least I was keeping up with all the newest steps. One Saturday night at work, when the cinema program was almost over, one of the usherettes asked me to turn on the main switch which controlled the lights in the dance hall. I rushed off like the eager beaver I was to do her bidding. The main switchboard was housed in a small room off the vestibule, and I went inside. I surveyed the big board about which I knew less than nothing and saw 2 levers, which looked to me like main switches. I had no idea which one of them controlled the dance hall lights, so, to make sure, I pulled them both. There was a bang, by diuresis negation ash, smoke billowed from the switchboard and the light went out. Guiltily I crept out into the vestibule to find total darkness and chaos. Patrons were running around shouting. The manager, waving a torch, frantically promised to refund money later. Usherettes waved torches to show panic-stricken people the way out, women cried, children howled, and strong men pushed and shoved their way to the exits. In that pitch darkness, one thing was as clear to me as day: there would be no more business done in either the cinema or the dance hall that night. There was the inevitable post-mortem on the following Monday, and I learned I had blown the main fuse of the entire building, and through my stupidity the company had lost hundreds of pounds. The sentence of the manager at this drumhead court-martial was instant dismissal. I became a member of the dispirited queue at the local labor exchange, and for the first time in my working life I was on the dole. Week followed hopeless week, and the scared, shamed feeling of the workless was with me all the time. I walked miles looking for work, and when the soles of my only decent pair of shoes were worn through, my grandmother cut out new soles from thick cardboard. Then, when she had polished the uppers with cherry blossom shoe polish and elbow grease, I was respectable again. Eventually the clerk at the labor asked me if I would consider leaving my hometown to take a job as a barman in a London public house. This offer put me in a quandary. My grandmother depended on the few shillings I squeezed from my dole money to help her to exist, and if I left St. Albans I wondered how she would manage to live. I was wondering how to solve this dilemma when I saw the contemptuous look on the clerk's face. It said, as clearly as if he had spoken, how much he despised the work-shy lower class, that they were always moaning about jobs and houses. When they were offered work they refused it, and when they were rehoused they kept coal in the bath. I would solve Gran's problem later as best I could, and I accepted the job in London. As it turned out, the public house was not actually in the heart of London as I had imagined. It was in Barkingside, Essex, a fairly country district with grass and trees and not the grimy streets and frowning buildings I had dreaded. The pub where I was to work was called the Fairlop Oak, and it was managed by a warm-hearted Irish couple who greeted me when I arrived like a long-lost friend, rather than the new potboy and general dog's body. I was shown into a clean little bedroom and told it was to be my very own. This was a particular joy for me, because for as long as I could remember I had had to share the upstairs bedroom in my grandmother's house with the lodger, who kept me awake with his whistling, gurgling snores. Not only was I to have the privacy of my own room, but its window overlooked the garden, and I woke up to the sight of trees and the sound of birds. Mr. and Mrs. Ryan were patient with my mistakes, and they encouraged my efforts to learn the trade, and for this very reason I picked up the work quickly. Before long I had graduated from pot boy and diuresis negation relighter to more responsible duties in the cellar and to serving behind the bar. I enjoyed the bar work, and I grew quite fond of some of the regular customers, who had their own tankards with their names on them displayed on a special shelf. The Oak was a cheerful and well-run public house, and I was happy there. I remember Mr. Ryan's passion for the records of John McCormack, the Irish tenor, and how all day long we worked to the sound of his golden voice singing all the Irish ballads the Ryans loved. Whenever I hear strains of Danny Boy, Killarney, Mother McCree or any of the others, even now am I transported back to the Oak, and I wish the Ryans well wherever they may be. On my days off I used to take the bus into town and spend my time visiting the museums and art galleries, occasionally going to the pictures. I began to think again of cutting a swathe in some dance hall, but when I compared my one and only suit with those worn by the men I saw up west I realized I was too shabby to venture into any of them. Obviously I must buy a suit, but however long I window shopped I found nothing cheaper than 30 shillings, which was an astronomical sum for anyone earning my wage. It looked as if I was foiled again, but kind Mr. Ryan came to my rescue, and he advanced me the 30 shillings for my suit if I agreed to repay the loan at 5 shillings a week. This meant I had to postpone my dance triumphs until my debt was paid, so that I could continue to send my grandmother a small amount via postal order each week. At last the great occasion came, and, wearing my new suit, shoes shining, hair slicked flat and with 10 reckless shillings in my pocket, I caught the bus and rode all the way to Piccadilly Circus in breathless excitement. I had already decided to patronize the Astoria Dance Hall in Charing Cross Road, because I had been told ladies to be found there would dance without the formality of a formal introduction. When I arrived I was dumb with wonder. The mirror-shine surface of the floor, the big band in smart uniforms, the exotic decor and the colored lights playing over the dancers were to me the summit of elegance and chic. I felt I was mingling on equal terms with the gilded youth of London. For a few minutes I stood on the sidelines to observe procedure. As far as I could judge, one simply chose one of the bevy of unaccompanied beauties, walked up to her and asked her to dance. Feeling very daring, I approached a dazzling blonde. She slid into my arms and soon we were circling the floor in fine style, exchanging brilliant snippets of small talk like did she come here often and what did I think of the band. I have to admit none of the other dancers broke into spontaneous applause after our performance, but I felt I was not letting Miss Florence down. I danced with various partners but I kept on returning to my blonde dazzler, not only because she was a good dancer but she had a trick of welding her body to mine which I found very exciting. In those days familiarity between the sexes was by no means as immediate as it is today and I was very thrilled when she said I could call her Muriel. At the end of the evening I had a problem. I wanted to dance the last waltz with Muriel but this would imply that I should take her home and I had no idea where she lived. I would gladly walk with her to Land's End, but a beautiful girl such as she was would undoubtedly expect a taxi and what with the entrance fee and all the lemonades I had bought for my partners, I had half a crown left for my bus fare home and to see me through until next payday. There was only one answer, I would not dance the last waltz at all. If I could not dance with Muriel I was not going to slight her by taking another partner. I was standing rather gloomily on the sidelines watching the last dance when two soft hands were clapped over my eyes, and I turned to find her smiling at me. "Will you walk home with me?" she asked. "My flat is only a few steps from here." I was caught up at once into the seventh heaven of bliss. The soft light from the street lamps made a nimbus of her blonde hair and Muriel looked very lovely to me as we walked down a narrow dingy street and stopped outside a door with paint peeling in strips, between a barber's shop and a wine store with its windows still lit up. Muriel opened the peeling door with her key to reveal a steep flight of wooden stairs. "Follow me," she said brightly. I muttered something about catching my bus. "Oh, come up for a short time," she insisted and taking my hand she pulled me up the stairs with her. I looked around Muriel's room vaguely wondering what was wrong with it. The furniture was shabby, but I was used to shabbiness, it was something else. It was a pink, frilly feminine room, there was a big Cupid doll in a feathered headdress on the mantelpiece and a pink teddy bear lay on the bed cover. A chintz curtain, riotous with sunflowers, concealed a gas stove and a shelf with pots and pans. Suddenly I knew what was wrong, I missed the soap and wax polish smell which pervaded my grandmother's home. This room was neglected, not quite clean. Muriel opened a wardrobe and took out a black filmy garment which she slung casually about her neck, and after excusing herself she left the room. Shortly I heard a tap running and wondered hopefully if she was filling a kettle for tea. Shortly the tap was turned off and Muriel came back into the room, wearing the black filmy thing she had taken with her and underneath it she was stark naked. I had had no experience to guide me in a situation of this kind so I suppose I just stood, rooted to the spot, looking every bit the country bumpkin, which in truth I was. Briskly my blonde divinity pulled back the bed cover and turned down the sheets. "Don't be scared if it's your first time. Muriel will show you the ropes." 5 minutes later, crushed, crumpled and ashamed, I was standing in the middle of the floor again. I stammered something about the bus and really having to go and made for the door, but before I got there Muriel was facing me like an avenging angel. "You'll put my £5 on the mantelpiece before you set foot outside that door," she shrilled. I stared at her in utter disbelief. In my name Akron Vetti I thought the two of us had been carried away by a sudden irresistible urge and although I was ashamed of giving way to what I thought was my lust, it had not entered my mind the transaction could be financial. When Muriel cottoned on to the fact I simply could not pay the 5 shillings she told me exactly what she thought of me and she did not mince her words or spare my feelings. By the time she had done with me I felt as if I had been pulled through a mangle and when she disdainfully ordered me to get out of her sight, thankfully I went. As I crept stealthily down the wooden stairs she appeared at the top to hurl a last insult, "You and your £30 suit." She spat venomously and then vanished from view. All the way back to Barkingside in between bouts of guilt and shame I kept wondering how Muriel could have known how much I paid for my suit. but when I reached the sanctuary of my little room at the Fair Lopok, I saw the price tag was still hanging from the tab at the back of the jacket collar. I had heard a great deal about the new talking picture at the Regal Cinema, Marble Arch. It was called The Singing Fool and starred Al Jolson, and all my customers in the bar raved about it. The more I thought about a picture talking, and in this case even singing, the more wonderful it seemed and the more I longed to see and hear it. At last the day came when I took my place in the long queue which stretched far down the edge where Odin prepared to inch forward with the rest for as long as it took to get into the Regal to see this new wonder. After standing for 2 hours or more, I sat down in my tip-up seat feeling all the usual thrill of anticipation and more as the lights were lowered. The Idaeris's Negation LM had not run for longer than a very few minutes before I knew its canned music could never replace the orchestral accompaniment to the big silent films. The actors' voices sounded strange and harsh, reminding me of very early gramophone records, and the magic the silent films had for me was simply not there. The people on the screen were no longer beautiful, glamorous or mysterious. Their voices were tinny and did not match the way they looked. This new miracle struck me as artificial and deadly dull. I came out of the Regal convinced this new craze for talking pictures could not last. It was a long time before I went to a talking picture again. Instead, I would seek out the small cinemas which had not been able to afford to install the expensive sound equipment, and I reveled in the old silent films they were forced to show. I remember one manager of such a cinema who put a placard outside his doors stating "Silence is golden," and I agreed with him all the way. In the early days of the talkies, which to my surprise continued to thrive, many of Hollywood's greatest stars disappeared from the Idaeris's Negation LM galaxy because their voices were unsuitable or discordant, and I began to think of Rudolph Valentino again. I wondered if his voice would have matched his grace and good looks, or whether he too would have been destroyed by sound. I thought perhaps he was fortunate to have died when he did, before the legend he had created could be ridiculed out of existence. Thinking in this way, I remembered those messages from Germany which begged me to develop mediumship to serve the world. I wondered what Valentino thought of me now, if truly the messages had come from him. I was certainly serving spirits, but hardly the kind he meant me to serve. But I had made my decision to get on with my life in my own way, so I pushed these thoughts to the back of my mind and forgot about Valentino. Sometime later on my day off, I decided to go to a live theater. After shopping around, I decided to patronize the Prince of Wales Theater, where they were performing what I thought was a nautical play called Outward Bound. I had always enjoyed films about the sea, and I had read Moby Dick, so I set off for the theater expecting to be well entertained. I discovered that Outward Bound had very little to do with the sea, but it had a great deal to do with life after death. True, I enjoyed the play. I thought it was a great and moving experience, but it seemed to me that the dead had caught up with me again. Was I was not to be allowed to escape what I had been told was my duty to mankind? Stupid as it may sound now, I felt my choice of this particular play had been forced upon me, as a sort of ghostly nudge towards the path I was expected to tread. That night in my little room at the Fair Lopok, I lay awake for hours thinking about the play, wondering if I should give up my job and go home to St. Albans to try and find a new group of people who would sit with me to help me develop my mediumship. Common sense warned me that I could not lightly give up a job I liked and where I was happy without any real excuse, and if I did, I would get no dole money from the labor exchange while I was out of work. I tossed and turned in my narrow bed wondering what to do, arguing with myself, first this way, then that, until at last I fell asleep. I awoke next morning bug-eyed, but knowing exactly what I was going to do. Then and there I gave Mr. Ryan the customary 2 weeks' notice, and when my next day off came around, I bought a cheap day return ticket and took the train to St. Albans. It was pleasant to be in my own hometown again, but I had a flock of butterflies Idaeris's Negation uttering in my stomach whenever I thought about how rash I had been to give up my good job at the Fair Lopok without any immediate prospect of another. As I wandered up the main street on my way to grandmother's house, I saw a card in the window of a tailor's shop, "Young man wanted." How I hoped that I was the young man they wanted, because I certainly wanted them. I went into the shop and asked to see the manager. He came out of the back premises and I asked if I might be considered for the vacancy. I answered his every question to the best of my ability, even telling him about my disaster in the cinema, which, to my relief, made him laugh. Eventually the butterflies swirling and I diaresis negation uttering in my stomach folded their wings and slept when he accepted me for the job. The wage was my standard rate of 12 shillings and 6 pence a week, and my duties were to include keeping the shop clean, polishing the show windows, delivering orders and any other tasks at which I could make myself useful. The last hurdle was crossed when he agreed to keep the job open for me while I worked out my notice in London. Once more I had burnt my boats and crossed my Rubicon, and I wondered what I would find on the other side. 5. I liked my job at John Maxwell's ready-to-wear shop for men. The manager and his assistant were kindly, my duties were lighter than any I had previously known, and I had my evenings to myself. In the morning I swept out, dusted and polished the shop, then standing on a stepladder on the pavement I washed and polished the big show windows until they shone. At least they shone to within a foot of the top, because I have never had a head for heights, and it was only on rare occasions that I forced myself to the top of the ladder to do the job thoroughly. For the rest of the day I did any odd job required of me, ran errands and delivered purchases to customers' homes. At my grandmother's home, where I was once again living, I sadly missed the privacy of my own room, which had been such a joy to me at the Fairlop Oak. I had to share a bedroom with George, our elderly lodger, once more, and try to ignore his snoring and his morning smell of stale sweat and last night's beer. At this time George was in his early 60s, and a taciturn man with the ruddy complexion of the countryman and a long mournfully drooping moustache. Sometime in the 1870s he had started work as a stable lad at the Old Mile House, an old coaching inn 1 mile from St. Albans, and he still worked there. For many years George had groomed the horses and polished the carriages of the gentry until the triumph of the motor car had closed the stables and reduced George to handyman at a wage of £1 a week. Like my grandmother, he could neither read nor write, and he never stopped grumbling about the disappearance of his beloved horses from the roads, or failed to curse the noise and stink of the motor cars. We had a parlour in our house which was always known as the front room. It was furnished with stiff Victorian armchairs, a round mahogany table with a bobble-edged tablecloth and sundry whatnots filled with bric-a-brac. There was a sideboard on which stood a tantalus containing 2 glass decanters, which never to my knowledge had held liquor, and which in my childhood had vanished to the pawn shop during periods of greater financial crisis than usual. There were 2 sets of curtains at the window, lace ones which were washed every Monday, and some heavy velvet drapes, which were kept half-drawn during the day in case the sun faded the patterned rug, which lay rakishly askew on the worn linoleum. There was red crinkled paper pleated into a fan in the empty grate, and the pottery vase holding dried bulrushes, which stood in one corner, could be thought to provide the touch which traditionally only a woman's hand can give. It was an important part of my grandmother's image of respectability to have a parlour, and she took great pride in her own. The mahogany furniture was polished until it shone, and she would get down on her knees to scrub the linoleum, and when it was dry she would get on her knees again to polish it with Roanoke floor polish. Once a week each worthless piece of bric-a-brac from the laden whatnots was washed in hot soapy water and dried with loving care. She spent hours mending the holes in her lace curtains, worn by age and too frequent washing, and darning them with small exquisite stitches, trying to recreate the pattern which had gone. It would have been quite unthinkable to use this Holy of Holies for any lesser occasion than Christmas Day or the funeral of a close relative, so we sat in the kitchen at all other times. When George and I came in from our work we were given a meal which was called tea, but in reality it was our main meal of the day. We would have pie and peas, sausages and mashed potatoes, or scrag end of mutton stew, washed down with mugs of strong tea and accompanied by unlimited bread and margarine. When T was over, the three of us would draw close to the minuscule diaresis negationary in the kitchen grate, Gran in her wicker armchair mending or knitting, George with his feet up on the sagging horsehair sofa smoking his old clay pipe, and myself sitting bolt upright on a wooden kitchen chair, since it was the only other place to sit. We hear a lot said these days about lack of communication between the generations, but I doubt if youngsters nowadays can imagine the almost total lack of communication which illiteracy can inflict.